Welcome to The Divine Breadcrumb with your hosts, Carol Campos and Deb Sorensen. Carol and Deb have always believed the universe helps people on their path by sending signs, clues, or what they call divine breadcrumbs. A divine breadcrumb can create both small and massive shifts in a person's life. On this podcast, Carol and Deb will speak with authors, healers, entrepreneurs, and other amazing people across the globe to discuss these pivotal moments. So get ready to learn, to love, and to laugh. And remember, the universe always provides if you allow it to. Enjoy the show.
Hi, this is Carol, co-host of The Divine Breadcrumb. I am so excited to talk to you about my new 10-week one-on-one coaching program, Energy, Esteem, and Empowerment. I designed this program for people who feel powerless, who feel like their self-worth has been damaged and continually attract toxic situations and people into their lives, but can't figure out why. And worse, they feel like they can't be who they really are. This is something I've been called to do for a long time based on my own experiences with trauma and abuse and my long journey to heal. In this program, we'll be focusing on uncovering your personal power, cultivating self-esteem and self-love, and doing deep energy work. It's time to remove the mask and let your true voice be heard. To learn more, go to carollcampos.com, click on the services tab, and then private coaching. Again, that's carollcampos.com, click on the services tab, and then private coaching. You can do this, and I'll be right there with you.
Hello, everyone. I'm Carol.
This is Deb. Welcome back to the Divine Breadcrumb.
Our guest today started her career in a fourth grade classroom, but now is a sought-after speaker lecturing on how the brain works and how to increase and optimize its function. Today we are talking with Dr. Melissa Hughes, author of Happy Hour with Einstein and Happier Hour with Einstein, Another Round. Melissa has worked with everyone from students in a classroom to boardrooms in Fortune 1000 companies. Melissa combines her PhD in education with her vast experience in marketing communications with extensive research in neuroscience and behavioral psychology to share simple, applicable strategies that improve outcomes both at work and in our personal lives. With energy and humor, Melissa provides tools to harness the skills to create a culture of learning and inspire organizations and teams to tap into their inner genius. And today we'll be talking with Melissa about how to manage stress and uncertainty, navigating the us versus them mentality, her book, Happier Hour with Einstein, why doodling is a good thing, as well as finding out what in the world is a neuro nugget. So get ready to geek out with us and have some fun. Melissa, welcome to the show. We're happy to have you with us.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. I love it when I get to geek out with other geeks. So thank you.
Yeah, non-geeks really have no idea how much fun this is.
They have no idea what they're missing.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, we encourage everyone to embrace your geekness or whatever that word would be. So if you would share with our listeners how you went from teaching in a fourth grade classroom to what you're doing now, you know, what was that pivotal moment that sent you on this trajectory?
Well, it's been a little bit of a journey, but I did start my career in a fourth grade classroom, and I have to share that I was that teacher. I was that teacher who would change the world one child at a time. And I had every mug with every cheesy teacher saying on it to prove it. And I loved teaching, but at the end of my first year, I sat down with my mentor and we kind of did a post-mortem on, you know, what worked really well and what do you want to get better at over the summer. And my question to her was, how am I going to be the best teacher I can be if I don't have any idea how the brain learns? Like, I'm supposed to teach these kids how to learn, and I don't know how the brain works. So I kind of, the journey kind of started there. And it's what's really interesting about that first year, this is, I'm going to show my age, so just look away for a minute. But my first year was the first year that we had the, I taught in Ohio, and it was the Ohio proficiency test. And it was the first time that I was ever involved in a high stakes testing situation. And what we did for, I don't know, 6 months, we started at the beginning of the year with, this is how you take a test. And these are all the test prep skills. And we worked through Ohio OPT, show what you know. I mean, I still remember all this stuff. It's crazy. But basically, we pumped these kids full of stress and anxiety over this test. And we said, now, you know, get a good night's sleep and make sure you eat eggs for breakfast. And we sent home flyers to mom and dad and saying, you know, this is how you can help them, remind them how to take a test and remind them all of this stuff. And then they come in on the day of the test and we say, now go in there and do your very best. And what I know now, what I didn't know then, but what I know now is that's simply impossible. You can't do your best thinking when the brain is stressed. I mean, because now, fast forward to where I am today, and what I've learned is that optimizing cognitive function is not confined to the classroom, number one. And number two, we as adults, hopefully we are more stressed out than our children. I mean, there are times that I think our kids are more stressed out than we are. But I mean, look around. Everybody's stressed out right now. And here's what we know. The brain develops from bottom to top and back to front, which means that the survival brain grows first. And this was like 5 million years ago. This is how cavemen, you know, were able to survive enemy cavemen and poison berries and saber-toothed tigers. And so it was that survival brain that was always on. The second part of the brain to develop is the limbic system, which is the part, it's where our amygdala lives. And this is how we manage and respond to emotions. And the very last part of the brain to develop is the neocortex, specifically the prefrontal cortex, which is the part of the brain that's right behind your forehead. And what's important about this is that this is where decision-making lives and impulse control and weighing risk and reward. And have you ever had one of those moments where you go, oh my God, what in the world was I thinking?
Yes.
You know, well, okay, well, probably we weren't thinking because that part of the brain gets shut down. When the limbic system says, there's a danger here, there's something to pay attention to, it automatically sends messages downstairs to the survival brain. And then the survival brain kicks in and says, danger, Will Robinson, danger. We need to deal with this threat. And it starts to pump out all kinds of stress hormones that actually, some of those stress hormones don't just come from the brain. Some of them come from glands all over the body so that you can prepare for fight or flight. But in the middle of all that, what it does is it pauses the prefrontal cortex so that it can allocate all neural resources to the threat, because the brain's primary job is to keep us alive. It's not to think. So, you know, when you understand that if we are busy trying to stay alive, if we are busy with survival, then we're not busy doing our best thinking. And you know, we all like to think that we're rational decision makers, rational thinkers all the time. And it's just simply not true. So, you know, I think right now you take a look around at where everyone, I mean, gosh, we have just a cornucopia of things to be stressed about today.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
I mean, so whether it's COVID or the economic crisis, or maybe, you know, a lot of families are going through a lot in terms of the job situations have changed for a lot of folks, or parents worrying about whether to send their school kids back to school and whether that's safe, or whether we can go visit grandma and grandpa at Thanksgiving. I mean, there's so many things to worry about. And I think the part of this that people don't understand is that uncertainty is more stressful than knowing something bad is going to happen. So there was a study done a couple studies. The one was, you know, they interviewed these folks who were being biopsied for breast cancer, women who were being biopsied for breast cancer. They surveyed them before the biopsy, when they got the biopsy, and then when they got the results. And they were the most stressed at the peak of uncertainty. When uncertainty is 50%, meaning there's a 50-50 chance that that bad thing can happen, that's when we are most stressed. And even after the biopsy, when they learned that they had breast cancer, they were less stressed knowing. Because then at least you can go, okay, now I know, and now I'm going to figure out what to do about this. Here's another really great example. Imagine you're driving in your car and you're heading to a meeting and you've left yourself plenty of time because if you're like me, you hate to be late for a meeting. And you come upon this massive traffic jam and you're sitting there. Now you look at your GPS and the GPS keeps adjusting the estimated time of arrival. And the longer you sit there, the closer you get to that point at which you're going to be late. And the closer it gets to that point that you know you're going to be late, the more stressed you get, right? The closer it gets. And then once you pass that point, even though the outcome is a negative outcome, you're going to be late. But you're not as stressed as you were 5 minutes ago when you didn't know for sure if you were going to be late, right? Because five minutes ago, there was still a chance. And now there's not a chance.
Right. There was that magic chance that you'd still get there in time.
Exactly. I mean, like, it's that point at which you consider actually driving off the road onto the berm and doing the like the whole, like, in the grass thing. Like, could I pull that off? Really, could I pull that off? Right. So I think understanding just, you know, how stressful uncertainty is the first step. Like, right now, there's so many things. We don't know what's going to happen at Thanksgiving, let alone, looking forward into 2021. So I think when we have conversations with people and I say, you know what, it's okay. It's actually, that's your brain is actually working correctly. If you're stressed out because you don't know what's going to happen, that's, you know, that it's working the way it's supposed to.
Right. Well, gosh, there's so much to unpack here. And I just wanted to go back real quick. When you were talking about the frontal cortex, at what age is that finished developing?
So the neocortex, which is the thinking part of the brain, it's the very top and front part of the brain. We used to think that that was done cooking by about late elementary school. And now we know that the prefrontal cortex, the part right behind your forehead, is not done cooking until our mid-20s.
Okay. So I actually kind of knew that. So I was just kind of putting it out there for the listeners. And the reason I bring it up is because with COVID and all the stresses we were just talking about, you know, there's teenagers and folks in their early 20s who right now, every issue feels so all consuming and it feels like it'll never be different. And now we know part of that is because that part of the brain isn't finish developing.
Exactly. Yeah, I just spoke at the Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association conference. And, you know, these are folks, the hospitality industry, as you know, has been hit terribly hard with coronavirus. And when you think about the demographics of a lot of the workers, especially in the fast food and the fast casual restaurants, you know, your McDonald's, your Panera's, your those kinds of restaurants. It's a lot of young people. And you know, I'm talking to these restaurant leaders. And one of the things that I really wanted them to take away was, look, these 19, 20-year-olds, their brains aren't done. So we have to help them. And the best way to help them is to talk about how stress impacts the brain and to talk about to try to find healthy ways to regain control and to get through those times of uncertainty, because we can't fix COVID individually. We can't do it, but we can learn how to cope and we can learn better coping strategies with the uncertainty piece of it.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah. Switching gears just a little bit. These days we hear the term neuroplasticity a lot on the internet, sort of everywhere. I mean, vitamin people talk about it, you know, crossword puzzle magazines talk about it. And there's all these recommendations to help improve it. Can you explain what neuroplasticity is and why is this important?
Yes. So this is so much fun. So I want you to think of the Charlie Brown Christmas tree. Do you see it?
Yes.
I see it.
See it?
Okay. I do.
So when we are first born, we have some what are called dendrites, but they're really like those tree branches. We have some of those, right? And those first couple years of life, when everything is new and novel, and we're discovering sounds and faces and voices and colors and shapes and all of those things, right? Then those branches, every time we learn something new, we grow connection, neural connections or dendrites or tree branches. That's the way I like to call them, right? So what happens is at about when we begin school, maybe age four or five, we start this pruning process because we start with the Charlie Brown Christmas tree and then pretty soon we've got all these dendrites and all these neural connections and we don't know exactly what to do with them. And when we start school and educators like to use this phrase, connect with prior learning, prior knowledge, right? And this is part of the neuroplasticity process because the brain operates on a use it or lose it principle. So when we start school and we start learning things in a much more formal way, we start to connect and strengthen those neural connections. So we'll connect one piece of learning to another piece of learning and go, aha, I get it. You connect the dots, right? But if you don't extend learning on one of those dendrites, then the brain has this natural pruning process. And it comes through, actually, it happens when we sleep. And one of the glial cells in the brain, when you are in that deep sleep, the interstitial spaces in your brain expand so that the glial cells can come in and think of them as the housekeepers. And they come in and they flush out all of the dead cells that we've killed with cortisol throughout the day, but also all of those dendrites that got pruned because we don't use them. And as an adult, I like to think of that random American history factoid that I studied for in high school and I remembered it for the test and now I have absolutely no idea what that is.
Yes.
You know, that was something that was a branch and it got pruned. Right? So the goal is to not go back to the Charlie Brown Christmas tree, but the goal is to get that Rockefeller Center Christmas tree. Like that's the one you want, right? It's nicely pruned and it's growing and, you know, it has all of there are no gaps. It's very filled in and everything's very connected because that's when we can make those, you know, that's where aha moments come from. Aha moments come from, well, I knew this thing over here and now I learned this thing over here and aha, I see how they connect. I get it now, right? So if you take nothing from me today, take the Rockefeller Christmas tree image in your head.
I love that. And I've also heard somebody explained that the reason we have the sensation that time passes faster when we're older is because we don't have as many new things in our brains. So there isn't these sort of points to measure the passage of like if you know, when you first learn to drive, that's a big deal, right?
Right.
So that's a point, right? Or these big events. But as you get older, there aren't these new events anymore. So things sort of all run together and it makes you feel as though time passes faster, which I thought was a fascinating idea.
Yes, that is exactly right. And one of the ways for those of us who are getting older, one of the ways that you can actually change that, and it isn't that you actually change the way time passes, but you change the way you perceive the passage of time, right, is to learn how to be much more introspective and reflective. And so, you know, they're looking, there are a lot of studies that are looking at the impact of journaling with seniors. And some of it is, you know, looking back on events in your past and reflecting upon how that specific event has shaped who you are today. And so instead of looking forward, looking to something, you're looking backward and I'm trying to understand how you have been shaped by that particular event. There's lots of emerging research on that. It's very fascinating.
That is fascinating.
I'm still loving the image of the Charlie Brown Christmas tree. And I'm thinking about all those gazillions of tests I took through school where, yes, the information just fell out of my head after the test.
Exactly, exactly.
Although I have to say, sometimes, rarely, but sometimes it will pop right back in again during Jeopardy. Just long enough, like, I know this answer, and then it's gone again.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's random factoids. Eli Whitney, the cotton gin. Right. Yes.
So that brings up another really interesting point, because as we sit on our couch and we're watching Jeopardy and we get these answers and we're looking at the people on TV and we're like, how could you not know that? Everybody knows that, right? But the people on TV, like, they are under the lights, and, you know, think about what's happening to you when you're in that kind of situation. It's the stress of the brain that's affecting the brain that is preventing that prefrontal cortex from operating the way it should. So even though there are those facts up there, there are those dendrites exist up there, it's the stress and the impacts, the effects of the stress that are preventing that prefrontal cortex from responding the way it should.
Ooh, that is interesting. And that makes sense. I'm the worst person to have on a team when there's some type of game like that, because my mind just goes blank as soon as I'm under pressure.
Yeah. It's like, if you have this really like difficult conversation and you're driving home and you go, man, I wish I would have said da 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 da, right?
Oh yeah. I have come up with the best comebacks in the car driving home, I can tell you.
Exactly.
We've heard you mention the, in quotes, us versus them mentality, which is very timely. How can we better navigate this?
So I think so many people, we all are experiencing it right now, whether it be, you know, the mask wearers versus the not mask wearers, or Republicans or the Democrats or the liberals or the conservatives or the, you know, whatever the us, whatever that issue is that you're grappling with right now. Chances are there's a them component, right? And part of that, just to understand where that comes from, is really the first step in figuring out how to navigate that, because we actually create orange barrels in our head, right? But here's the thing. This is another ancestral hand-me-down. You know, our cavemen had to know that the enemy cavemen were bad, and the, you know, the family cavemen were good. And so we have evolved over millions of years with this us versus them mentality. And I'll use an analogy that won't be quite as controversial as some that I could choose right now. I'll use the Ohio. I'm from Ohio. I grew up in Akron, Ohio, actually. And in Ohio, doesn't matter if you like football or hate football, you must be an Ohio State Buckeyes fan, period. It's just, and not only do you have to be an Ohio State Buckeyes fan, but you have to hate Michigan. So, you know, I am not a huge, I'll be honest, I'm not a huge football fan, but that is so ingrained in the culture of Ohio that you are, it's go Bucks, it's O-H-I-O, and it's, you know, boo blue, right? That you grow up with that you learn that when you learn your fruits and vegetables and your colors and numbers, right?
Yeah.
So I use that because everybody has that friendly rivalry that you can kind of think about that. If I walk into a store and I see someone who's wearing a t-shirt supporting a particular candidate, especially right now, because they're, you are on one side of the fence or the other. You are us or you are them. And you know nothing about that person except for the shirt that they're wearing. The only thing you know about that person is that they support that particular candidate. And within a split second, you have already formed an opinion about that person. Mm-hmm. And if it's us, if that person is one of us, then you are much more likely to help that person with their groceries or, you know, whatever, if they let them cut in line, whatever the thing is. And if they're them, you're much more likely to go, man, you're on your own. Like every man for himself. Like, mm-hmm. you know, when you take a step back, and I've done this myself. I mean, it's instinctual. So it's not like you can say I'm above that. I don't do that. It's like I said, we can thank the cavemen for it. Because we can't help it. But I'll be driving down the road and I'll see a bumper sticker and I will immediately form an opinion about the person driving that car. Immediately.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, and I have to back myself down and say, okay, that's not me. That's my caveman brain talking and I'm much more evolved than that. And I know that there's more to that person than the bumper sticker on the back of their car. But I think you have to have that understanding about the us versus them mentality. And I've written, you know, a bunch of stuff if you really want to dig into the science of it, but really just understanding that it's there and then catching yourself when you do it, because I guarantee you will do it today. Mm-hmm. I guarantee you it happens all the time.
Well, and it seems to be getting worse, stronger, more segregated. 10 years ago, yes, we had political opinions, but you still talked to people that had the other opinion. Now it's almost like this immediate, nope, I can never speak to you because you're wrong.
Exactly. Exactly. And so part of this is one of the things that the brain is amazing. I mean, it is just absolutely amazing. But one of the things that the brain really sucks at is determining the difference between a physical threat and a psychological threat. So that, I'll take masks because that seems to be a big issue in my neck of the woods right now. The people who wear a mask, well, you must be part of this particular group and I'm against that particular group, therefore I'm against you. And we are on opposite sides of the fence, even though we live in the same community. And people would say, well, I'm wearing a mask to protect you. And the people who are not wearing the mask are like, well, I'm not wearing a mask to protect our rights. And so each person is very entrenched in their own rightness. But ultimately, what's going on in both brains is there is a threat. It is a psychological threat. It's a threat to their psychological safety, which the brain cannot often tell the difference. It treats it the same way it would if somebody came up to you and threatened to punch you in the nose.
Right. Yeah, that's fascinating because obviously we've all been noticing this. And one of the things I've been doing, I take walks at a lake near my house. And, you know, I would say I'm pretty sensitive to people's energy and noticing this and feeling it. And I thought, okay, how can I kind of protect myself? I recently made a concerted effort to look for commonalities because there are some people that walk and they're wearing a hat with the name of a certain candidate or whatever. And just striking conversations with them. And, you know, we got to talking about nature or the birds that have migrated or whatever. And then, and once again, seeing them as humans, not as a party or as an enemy. And it's really helped. But again, it's taken an effort to do it because it's exactly what you said, Melissa. It's right away, I'd see a name or a bumper sticker and, you know, I'm already in fight or flight mode.
That's exactly right. And I think that what you've just described is probably one of the most valuable strategies that any of us can intentionally hone. And that is start every conversation on common ground. Every conversation. Now, that's really easy for the people who are in your us group, right? Not so easy for the people in the them group. But to your point, there's always common ground. It might not be about the candidate or the masks. Maybe it is about how beautiful a day it is. Maybe it is about, look at that rainbow, right? whatever, there's something that you can find to put you on common ground with that person. And that would be my challenge for everyone in these really, really weird, divisive times, is to intentionally strive to start every single conversation on common ground. And it sounds very easy. It really does sound very easy, but I'm here to tell you that I have failed. I have failed miserably. And yet I keep trying.
So. Right.
And that is all we can do, is just keep trying. I mean, that's the point. Just everybody's human and just try. And if everybody tries, right?
Exactly. And you know, we all have that person in our family. Mm. I mean, right now, you know, I remember this time last year, we weren't talking about COVID. We were talking about how to survive Thanksgiving without killing your family members over who is sitting in the White House or not. And this year it's very different. It's, are you even going to sit around the table with Thanksgiving with your family? And what I'm reading is perhaps that's the silver lining of COVID, is that you don't have to have Thanksgiving this year, you know? And so I think we all, if we assume that challenge, if we just accept that challenge as, I'm going to see how many times I can start a conversation today on common ground with that person, whether I know that person or not, there are a couple things happen in your brain. And this is the part where I get super, super geeked out, because when you know what's going on in your brain, it's even more delicious. So when you start that conversation on common ground and you make a human connection with another person, your brain starts to produce oxytocin. And oxytocin is the love hormone or the cuddle drug, and it's what we get when we have sex and when we just give someone a hug. And the biggest surge of oxytocin comes when a mother breastfeeds her child, because of that bond, because oxytocin is the bonding molecule, right? But both of you, if you start that conversation on common ground, you both generate oxytocin. And oxytocin facilitates activity in the prefrontal cortex. So if you want to have conversations using your best brain, then you start with oxytocin, and you start with healthy amounts of dopamine and healthy amounts of serotonin. But oxytocin is really that, you know, we don't just coexist. We actually share a human connection. And thanks to mirror neurons, in less than 60 seconds, we can actually create a neurochemical change in the person that we're with. And when you think about that is like so powerful, right?
Yes.
So powerful. So if it's that cranky old guy who doesn't support the same candidate that you do, that lives at the end of your street, and I'm not talking about anyone in particular, the best thing you can do is actually create a neurochemical change in his brain and yours. Because now when you start from common ground, you're both going to start that conversation with your best thinking brain. And you might still not agree. That's the other thing. You can't go into these conversations with the hope of persuading. We have to learn how to go in with the hope of understanding.
Well, this is so amazing as you're talking about this. So I have a real life example. There's this older gentleman I see walking, and he's really kind of a curmudgeon. He'll barely give you a hello. And last week I had stopped because there's an office where the park rangers are that I pass by before I get on the trails. And there was a rose bush, and I went over to smell the roses. Well, inside one of the roses was a bumblebee kind of laying on her back, kind of cleaning herself. And I was fascinated. So I'm just standing there. He starts walking up and he kind of glances at me. And I said, oh, there's a bumblebee in the rose. He said, oh, really? For the first time. I mean, we've passed each other for like a year. He's never talked to me. He came over. We started talking about nature. By the end of the conversation, I knew his name. He had offered me to lend his kayaks if I ever wanted to use it. I mean, it's like we became fast friends. And I walked away on a high. And I feel like he was felt happier too. It was an amazing experience.
Yeah, that is like, so here's what I would love to see. So after your listeners hear this thing, so here's my challenge. Somewhere on your website, there's a place for them to share that experience, the bumblebee experience. Share your bumblebee experience, right? Because if everybody does it, just think, if everybody just did one cool thing like that today, like, because here's what's going to happen. After he left you, he was on a high, and his next interaction was probably equally as positive.
Yeah.
And yours too.
Yeah. It was great.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have a not as dramatic a story, but similar. The local convenience store where I used to go and get my coffee in the morning, and weekdays it was always the same woman behind the counter. And I wouldn't say she was miserable. She clearly was not thrilled about being there, and she was a little grumpy, and like you got maybe a grunt. and I just started every morning. I would walk in, good morning, what a beautiful day. And I would get my coffee and then I'd chat with her. And then within a week, I would say, when I would walk in, she'd be like, hey, honey, how you doing today? It's nice to see you.
Yes. See, that's delicious, isn't it? And
yes.
Now you know that you are generating oxytocin and that you are literally changing the chemistry of her brain. Like, yeah. Literally. Like,
that's so cool.
That just feels so good. And your own brain, too.
Yeah, right.
So, and then the cherry on top of that beautiful sundae is that your brain is actually working better, too.
Right.
Right? So, I mean, I think we could all use a little, like, IQ boost these days, because there's a lot of people that are behaving dumb.
Yes. So on that note, tell us a little about your book, Happier Hour with Einstein, which this is a second iteration of the idea. Tell us about the first book, and then why did you do a second book, and why did you feel that this was needed at this time?
Well, I started about, can't even believe it, it's been 6 years since I've been doing NeuroNugget. So I deliver a NeuroNugget every Friday, and it's before I started doing the NeuroNuggets, I would be that person. I would learn something about the brain, and then I would be on an airplane, and I would be sitting next to someone on an airplane, and they would start, you know, small talk, which was probably a rhetorical, and I would launch into this big, long thing about, you are never going to believe what I learned about the brain today. And so I would have to share this amazing thing. And so I decided to do this NeuroNugget, and it's a 3 to 5 minute video. I deliver it every Friday. I don't junk up your mailbox with a whole bunch of other things. And I'm really not salesy. Actually, I suck at selling. So there's that piece, but it is just this some fascinating thing about the brain. And my mission is to help non-neuroscience geeks understand how the brain works and how to make it work better. Because I get that not everybody likes to dig into the research like I do. I love the research, and I am that geeky girl. But I do believe, even though people don't have that same passion for the research that I do, I think everybody wants to know how to make their brain work better. And so the goal of the NeuroNuggets, and then off of that, the books, Happy Hour with Einstein, and then obviously Happier Hour with Einstein, is to distill the science down into the part that people actually care about. Like, this is what it is, and this is how it impacts your brain, whatever that thing is, right? And whether that is for focus or creativity or collaboration, or, you know, I do a lot with cognitive biases, because cognitive biases happen in our subconscious. We don't even know they're happening. But once you understand those biases, then you'll start seeing them in action. And I will literally have to think to myself, okay, that's the negativity bias, or that's the, you know, whatever bias it is. And you'll see it happen. And that is my cue to take a step back and go, okay, that's not my thinking brain. That's the shortcuts that are happening in the brain, because the brain processes so much information. You can't be thoughtful about every single piece of data that comes in. You just can't. It's impossible. So the book, Happy Hour with Einstein and Happier, really the idea was to let everybody get geeky without getting, you know, lost in the weeds of the science. That was the basic premise. And I've gotten great feedback from it. People enjoy.
That's fun. And I love the title, and I did peek on Amazon. It looks like a lot of fun and fascinating.
Yeah. And I've subscribed to the Neuro Nugget. So I've gotten, it was a few weeks ago. I think it's every Friday they come out.
Every Friday. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just so enjoyable. And, you know, Deb and I were talking before you came on, Melissa, that you must have been such a favorite teacher with the kids when you were teaching, because you just deliver information in a way that's just so fun and interesting and not dry in the least.
Well, I appreciate that. I will say that I have heard from, you know, many, many years later that my students now have children, which is just impossible. But what's funny is that I have had kids, you know, my former students reach out to me and say, I remember that multimedia slideshow that I did on Tony Hawk, and you let me do it on the computer because I didn't want to do the book report like on pencil paper. Like, and I'm just like, oh my gosh, you remember that? Like, but here's the thing, you know, I said this earlier, and I don't think that there were ever truer words to be spoken. We are lifelong students, and we all learn differently, and there are orange cones like in our brain that prevent us from being our best thinkers, from being our best problem solvers, from being our most creative. And when you understand where those orange cones are and how to get around them, just the same way you do driving down the street and there's a closed road, you figure it out. And then now you've got another route to get around that, you know, closed road. And we do the same thing in our brains all the time. It's just some of us are, what separates the best of us from the rest of us, I think, is really understanding what either enhances or impedes cognition, creativity, problem solving, decision making, all that stuff. So yeah, I mean, I think that we all are lifelong students.
Yes.
Absolutely.
I love that. And before we wrap up, I have to ask, Carol mentioned it in the intro. Let's talk about doodling. I'm a big doodler.
Yes,
I've been doodling through this whole interview.
I'm glad you said that, Deb, because I was going to say it if you didn't.
So let's talk about it. Why is this a good thing?
So first of all, most of us are, all of us process visual images far quicker than we do text or words. So that's one thing. But when we try to put a concept down on a piece of paper and we use doodles, what we do is we open our brain up into what's called a flow mode. And there are lots of very famous geniuses who are known for flow mode, one of which being my favorite guy, which is Albert Einstein. But what I have started to do, and here's another challenge. See, look, I'm giving your listeners all kinds of challenges today, which is cool.
Love it.
What I have done in my practice is to, another way that I kind of differentiate myself from like every other speaker out there is when I go to speak, I actually put my talk down on an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper in words and arrows and pictures and everything like that. So when you look at and you can actually see some of these on my website, they're called sketch notes. And when you look at the sketch notes and you look just at a glance, like my goal is that, you know, within a minute or two, you can look at these sketch notes and you can understand what the talk is going to be about, but you are also going to learn something immediately. And what happens in my brain when I'm creating these sketch notes is I am reinforcing how concepts fit together, because I've got one piece of paper to doodle this all on, and it all has to kind of fit together. And if you think of it like putting a puzzle together, and to those folks who say, I'm not artistic and I can't draw at all, if you can draw 5 shapes, then you can doodle. And there's a great book by Sunny, hold please, Brown. It's by Sunny Brown, and it's called The Doodle Revolution. And she has a TED Talk out there. But if you're interested in putting doodling to work, she actually digs into the neuroscience of it as well. And it's just fascinating. And by the way, it's more fun. And I will tell you this one very, very fast story. So I would, when I first started learning how to doodle and how to like really doodle with intention, I was at a meeting, and this was back when I was working for a different company. I wasn't off on my own. And I was sitting at a conference room table with very important people. Like, you know, I was not at the top of the food chain, and I was sitting with a whole bunch of folks at the top of the food chain. And there was a senior VP sitting right next to me, and I'm doodling. And to be clear, it takes a more concentration to create a doodle of a conversation or a meeting than it does to just jot down words. So you are hyper-focused when you're doodling. And he leans over to me and he says, "Are we interrupting you? I mean, are you bored with this meeting?" And he did it in such a rude way. It was like really to call me out, like I wasn't paying attention. And I said, "Well, actually, I'm paying more attention by taking notes this way. And I'm happy to provide the science for you after this meeting. If you'd like, I'd love to share it all with you." And he clearly was not my best friend after that meeting. But it does require more mental focus to doodle. And so I highly recommend it. And it's just way more fun.
I definitely want to look up the Doodle Revolution. That's really cool. I hadn't heard of it before. Oh my gosh, Melissa, we could talk to you for hours. It's so fun. You'll have to come back.
Yeah, so many things we didn't even get to. Mindfulness, music, tons of stuff we didn't even get to today.
Exactly.
So what else is coming up for you?
So what I am doing is I am working a lot with navigating the stress, and I'm working with organizations to help their people manage this weird time that we're in, because we are in such an unprecedented time right now. And, you know, so a year ago, people were working on, I don't know, how to put recognition programs in place, and, you know, whether to spend the money on a foosball table or, you know, $50 pizza certificates for their people. And now it's really like, how do we really support our people? Well, the visionary leaders are talking about, how do we really support our people right now? Because this is such a strange time. So a lot of my upcoming speaking engagements are in that direction. And obviously I'm doing a lot more on, you know, in the virtual world, which is a big learning experience for all of us.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and then just keep doing what I'm doing. I'm working on another book. So yeah.
Great.
So like, learning never stops. Learning never stops.
Thank goodness.
Yes.
It's my favorite thing.
Mine too.
Right?
Yes.
So I want to know the bumblebee moments. I really want you to like put that out there for folks. Like, I think that
great
would be
idea.
So much fun to understand what everybody's bumblebee moment is.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, absolutely.
Look, I just totally hijacked you. Sorry.
No, I love it. I love it. Well, Melissa, thank you so much for spending time with us. This has been so much fun, as I knew it would be.
Yes, absolutely. And where can people find you online, Melissa?
They can find me at my website is melissahughes.rocks, R-O-C-K-S.
Awesome.
And also on LinkedIn. But if you check out my website, you can find me on LinkedIn from there. You can also sign up for the NeuroNugget from there. And you can reach out and just shoot me a note from there if you are looking for someone to come to speak to your group.
Excellent. And we will put all of that in our show notes as well.
Fantastic.
Thank you so much. I knew this was going to be a blast, so I'm so glad you could join us today.
Thank you, guys. This is great. I love getting geeky, so thanks for the opportunity.
Everybody, thanks for joining us today. As always, you can find the show on our website, thedivinebreadcrumb.com, Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and most recently, Amazon Music. We hope that you enjoyed the show. If you have any ideas for a show, or if you know somebody that you think would make a great guest, just jump on our website. There's a contact page and let us know. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks, everybody, for joining us, and we will see you next time.
Hi, everyone. If you love the Divine Breadcrumb podcast and the stories we're sharing, please consider supporting the show by making a donation on our Buy Me a Coffee page. You can set up monthly donations or make a one-time donation in any amount you choose. just go to thedivinebreadcrumb.com and click on the Support TDB tab, or you can go to buymeacoffee.com/TDB. Again, that's buymeacoffee.com/TDB. We're forever grateful for your support.